Hey everyone, this amazing ESO Network show is brought to you by our fine sponsor, Amazon.com. Please remember to shop Amazon for all your geeky needs, no matter what time of the year it is. All you need to do is go to ESOpodcast.com/ESOAmazon or click on the Amazon banner on the ESO Network webpage to go to our e-store. It's the best way to shop and the best way to support this program, and it doesn't cost you anything extra. Okay, that's enough of me babbling for now. Now on with your regular scheduled show.
White Rocket Entertainment.
White Rocket Entertainment, podcast number 254.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition, 2, 1, 0, we have a liftoff. We have a liftoff and it's lighting up the areas. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and this week I'm joined by John Hudgens, the producer of the official Babylon 5 convention videos, along with author and all-around super cool person Bethany Kessler, to talk about Ready Player One, the book and the upcoming movie. This is a conversation that the three of us had as a panel at DragonCon 2016 in Atlanta. It was a 10 o'clock in the late evening panel. That's late for me. I know some people are just getting started at 10 o'clock, but it was a late evening panel. I wasn't feeling the greatest for this panel, so I sort of backed off and let John and Bethany pretty much lead the way with it. And I appreciate them doing so. And I think it turned into a pretty good conversation about Ready Player One. So here we go. I present the Ready Player One panel from DragonCon 2016 in the Sci-Fi Literature track.
All right. I want to thank everybody for coming out at 10 o'clock on a Friday night. You made me all so proud. I really thought we could do a Ready Player One panel and it would be a success. I'm already calling it a success. We haven't even talked about anything yet. Way to go. The fact that we are here is just awesome. So you are all the winners. So thank you. We are here to talk about a really cool, awesome book by Ernie Cline called Ready Player One. And I've certainly got lots to say about it and about him and that kind of thing. So we will let our other two panelists introduce themselves, and I'll introduce myself, and then we're going to dig into it.
Hey, you go ahead and introduce yourself.
Let's let ladies first.
I'm Bethany Kessler. I'm a historian and media reviewer and writer, and I grew up with a lot of the stuff that he has references to in this book, and so when I figured out it was a love letter to the 80s, I asked Ben if I could be on this panel. So,
My name is Sean Hudgens. I'm the exact same age Ernie was. We've talked about this in the past. So yeah, this is me. But I'm a filmmaker and visual effects artist. I've worked on projects like Babylon 5, Star Wars, MechWarrior, and I have a couple of documentary films of my own out. So. I have read the book. I forgot about the panel, so I didn't reread it to bone up, so I will do my best.
And I'll just point out, Bethany's an awesome writer, and John is an awesome movie maker, because your Babylon 5 things have been my favorite things at Dragon Con for so many years.
Well, hopefully they'll give me a separate thing for that next year.
They weren't able to get it in this year. Yeah, this first year, and they're just getting started. So, I'm Van Allen Plexico, and I've written 14 science fiction novels. The new one's coming out as soon as the interior artist finishes the last illustrations. They got illustrations any day now. And I am a professor of history and political science at Southwestern Illinois, and I'm the host of the White Rocket Podcast, where we talk about pop culture stuff every couple of weeks. So that's the very stuff that I do. So let's talk about Ready Player One. Let's see. Has everybody read it? Anybody's read it? Yes? All right.
Give me a minute.
How many have listened to Will Wheaton's audiobook of it? You got, yeah. It's so, it adds so much to it, amazingly. Not least of which is when Will Wheaton talks about himself in the book. That's awesome. So it's a great book, and it's a great audio. Now, let's first ask, are either of the other two panelists want to say it's not a great book, or it's not an entertaining book, or is there anything...
Fuck no.
All right. Well,
yeah, what he said.
Was it you, Bethany, or was it somebody else that when I talked about it coming up, they said, well, wait, is... Was it you that said, is everybody against it or anything? Because you'd been on one before. Maybe I'm thinking about somebody else.
I think you're thinking about someone else.
Yeah. I talked to somebody about it, and they said I was on a panel about it at another convention a year or so ago, and I was the only person that liked it, and they said, I don't want to be on it again if everybody else hates it. I'm like, hates it? I'm like, what panel were you on?
No, the one thing I do remember is when I got my first copy of it, I opened it up at like about 11:30 at night, and it's like, I'll read a chapter. I went to bed around 7, and I was about 3/4 of the way through the damn thing.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know any people who hate this book, and honestly, you know, I don't need that negativity in my
absolutely,
life.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, let's talk about how it came to be and then what it is. My understanding, he's a movie, you know, script writer, right? More of a movie writer.
Well, he was a fan in Austin. Right. I don't know if you, not too many people are, I don't know how many of you are aware of the movie he had made before this. The movie Fanboys, you know, which was a little controversial for a while because, you know, the Weinsteins tried to recut it. That actually started as a fan film that he was going to make by himself in Austin. And through an incredible series of coincidences, somehow he ended up with Dana Brunetti, and Kevin Spacey got a hold of it and decided to produce it as a real movie, you know. But, you know, this was sort of like his follow-up to Fanboys, you know.
Well, and the funniest thing about it to me is that he wanted to write a book that was basically unfilmable as a movie, and before it was even published, it had already had a bidding war among movie studios.
Well, what's interesting is it's still going to be somewhat unfilmable because there's a lot of this. Well, Spielberg is not going to use a lot of the Spielberg references because
said he wasn't going to use anything of
it. Well, no, there's some of it. I think the way they're going to break that down is they're going to use the stuff that he produced because, like, you can't get around not using the DeLorean in this, I don't think. But yeah, but from what I've read, they've cut out a lot of Spielberg references, but not all of them because, you know, that sort of cuts out the heart of the book.
Yeah. Yeah, he chose Warner to win the bidding war because he thought they had the most stuff he wanted to use, right?
That I don't know.
That was my understanding, is he went with the studio that had the most of the things he had come up with available, which makes sense, you know, but... But so this book is a good example of how you can write about stuff if it's used in this way and not, like, in other words, you could write about Superman, you just couldn't write a Superman book, you know what I'm saying? So he uses all these things that should have gotten him sued, except the way he uses them are in passing, you know, pop culture references rather than... Mm-hmm. You know, like an actual story.
Yeah, but some of it, you know, like when I remember reading it the first time, when you get into the stuff, you know, where you're pulling out X-Wings and stuff like that, I mean, it's certainly doable, but it's going to be one of those cases with Roger Rabbit, where you're going to need some kind of visionary behind the scenes who can basically go to each of these studios and convince them that this is the greatest idea ever, that you'd be a moron not to let us have these things, which is what Spielberg did for, you know, this Roger Rabbit would not have happened if Spielberg hadn't have been the guy behind it.
I mean, and there's so much in this book that is just, you know, you read something or you get one of the references and immediately your brain flashes back to that point to where you saw the movie the first time.
Or the video game.
How many of us played, you know, what was it?
Joust.
You know, well, no, Adventure on the old 2600.
Oh, yeah. There's Adventure. I mean, the ones that stick out to me are the Last Starfighter. The ones he uses as his passphrases, you know, you have the Last Starfighter, you have Tron, you have Sneakers. And then you've got, so all these different references for all this different stuff. And I'm just sitting here going, this was, you know, my entire childhood. Because when you're raised by nerds, You are raised well.
Well, he cuts across such a wide swath of like the late 70s through the 80s, because, and there's some stuff that overlaps a little bit, hangs over the edges, because there's some stuff that I was going, I think I was off in college at that point, and I'm not really sure what he's talking about. And there's other stuff.
Well, I think the point is, though, that the character, Haskell,
Wade.
Not Wade. The older character, the one who sets the whole plot in motion. You know,
oh, right.
Request. You know, he is a person who is... You know, the book's set in, what, the 2040s? So, but he's a person who would have been my age and, you know, the same age, you know, as Ernie, who would have been experiencing all this stuff through the 70s and the 80s. You know, so that's where that ties in, because it's not Wade and them who are fans of all this stuff. You know, because, you know, they're another 40 years on, well, 30 years on from now.
Yeah. And some of the background for why this became so popular and some of Wade's world and the way it's developing, you know, I'm sitting here looking at this. Because I was rereading it about a week ago, looking at that, and then looking at the nightly news, and then looking back at this novel, going, "Okay, guys."
You know, oh, it's not just current events. He's also working in. I mean, there's a lot of Snow Crash in the Oasis in this.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of different influence. It's amazing the amount of stuff that's that's in here.
And it's worth noting too. I mean, you know, everybody gets hung up on the pop culture references, and then of course the through plot. But it's a pretty good, if you look at the settings around it, the stuff he just touches on every now and then, it's a pretty good dystopian American novel.
Yeah, I mean
you could drain all the, you know, references out and still be a novel about a few decades down the road, the United States, the fossil fuels, like, problem, and the climate
stats.
And
like the image of the stats.
Absolutely.
And I'm sitting here going, okay. On one hand, I'm kind of surprised we actually haven't come up with a way to do this yet. And on the other hand, this is kind of terrifying, because you do. It's a dystopian future where it's the whole thing about virtual reality. You know, you prefer that to your actual life because it's better.
Exactly. And I think that's the main message of the book is humans retreat into a fantasy world because they don't want to have to deal with the serious problems they're facing in their in their environment and in their countries and their cities and everything. I mean, you know, like the third time I read it, I was focusing on that, on how really, I mean, let me just jump to the end for a second just to make this point. All right, hurry up, John. At the end, this is what I love. At the end, Wade is given the off button. And I'm thinking, if he had wanted to be just a little more brave, Klein could have ended the book with Wade just going, screw it. You know, we're better off.
That right there?
Yeah, he could have just pushed that. I thought, you know what, if they did a sequel, now we're going to talk about this, but if they wanted to make a trilogy, then the second book should be called Ready Player Two.
Yeah.
And well, the third book
set that up. I mean,
and the, not working on a
and the oh, I don't know what he's going to call it. I'm just my theory. And the third book where he pushes the damn button should be called Game Over.
Yeah, I mean,
take it all away, because we've gone down this rabbit hole of virtual reality and we're letting the planet go to crap.
Well,
hit the button, man, and eject, you know.
Well, and it's this is far from the first thing that's showed us something like that, because you also have, like, WALL-E is another example of that. But Ready Player One, just the idea of the stats and the idea that this kid has gone out of his way to come to this car right over here that's, you know, deserted, that's his hideaway. And then the idea, you know, like the moment when the idea hits him that, yes, the Sixers will actually kill for this knowledge. They will actually murder everyone you know for this knowledge to be able to have control of this. I mean, that moment there for Wade is just like, I keep flashing back to that every time I reread it, because I'm just like, that moment where he realizes, oh crap, this has consequences, like actual severe consequences. And he's like, well, now I have to actually, you know, figure out what we're doing with this. You know, my actions are not just my actions, they actually have weight.
And then when Daito, whichever, or Shoto, whichever one it is, that gets pitched over the balcony, realizes it's a worldwide, you know.
It's a worldwide thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Have you guys, I only read it once, and I liked it because I got pulled in with the nostalgia. But overall, didn't you feel that it was a very predictable book? Only like one area caught me off guard and was beautiful. I love it, and I don't want to spoil it for anybody else. But
I think
overall,
we're spoiling.
I thought it was a very predictable book.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, it's not, you know.
What's wrong with predictability?
Yeah, I was going to say, you get to a certain point where, especially if you consume a lot of media, where, yeah, you can spot the marks where you kind of know where it's going, but it's kind of how they get there that's kind of the fun of it. And yeah, no, he threw a couple of curveballs where I'm like, oh, that's okay,
yes.
That's interesting.
That the kidnap thing, absolutely.
Yeah.
That, well, as soon as I start reading about the kidnap, I knew what that was happening. I knew what was happening with the arcade. The only curveball was who was who.
Yeah, the arcade thing, I remembered that. I was like, okay, that.
The facades that we
right.
were, and you're right,
okay.
We're all retreating in this little bubble. And it's very evident today.
So to piggyback off of that, before we get to your question over there, H is my favorite character for precisely that reason, because, yeah, you know, as a person who grew up with the internet, granted, my first operating system was DOS, because despite this baby face, I actually am that old, but I love H, and I love the concept of H, and I love the what he did with that character and that reveal.
Yeah.
Because it is very, very true to what we go through on a regular basis, you know, with the internet and stuff. I mean, that's why you have gender-neutral, you know, pen names, you know, because it'll sell better. Or you say, yes, my avatar picture is of my favorite book and not of myself. So, yeah, you had a question.
Well, actually, I wanted to address his question. I feel like the predictable nature is an inherent part of the book, in the sense that a lot of the 80s movies and stories that they reference were also very predictable in their storytelling, and it provides a comfort for it.
Yeah.
I moderate the Ready Player One subreddit, and that's sort of a shared theme among people on that board. Is everybody loves that comforting nature of, I know exactly what's going to happen, this is where it's going, and it's a fun ride from beginning to end, and it's like, yay, I've been down this path a million times before, I've read all these stories, I've seen all these stories. So, yeah, like, I mean, yes, absolutely predictable, but I feel like if it weren't predictable, it would alienate itself a little bit more from all the sources.
Yeah, if it weren't as predictable, I don't think it would actually have gotten as much success as it has gotten.
It'd have a cult following, minorly, but not the way it's going now.
I can understand. It's like riding a favorite roller coaster.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I can see that.
Yeah.
This is your highlight reel roller coaster.
It is, yeah.
It's got the deepness to it, though. It's not like it's just kind of fluff on the top.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like every backstory that had another backstory.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you went down
the
holiday road, liking what's-his-name's girlfriend, and that whole backstory there.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
Him living in, you know, it kept getting deeper and deeper and deeper. And sometimes you wonder, okay, we're going to come back to the story. Okay, we're back to the story.
And we're back to the
story. That was really good.
But it's like 80s movies, deep characters, straightforward story.
Well, the fluff is like, you know, that's what gets the mundanes in. You know, it gets people to pick up the book, you know, because, oh, you know, it's going to be, Reference City, and then they, you know, you find, ooh, more.
Yeah.
I think somebody...
So there's this complicated literary term I can't think of, but it's like something, and it's about, like, it's the coming-of-age novel. And that, I mean, that basically is what Ready Player One kind of is in a way. And like I tell people, if you were alive during the 80s, if you played these games, if you watched these movies, you're going to understand this game because you're going to have, you know, when he feels a certain way at a certain time, you're going to say, oh my God, I totally remember going to school and all the, you know, kids saying, oh my God, you're wearing the wrong clothes. And oh my God, like, that's not what your hair should look like. And wait, you listen to who? Because we're all listening to Milli Vanilli, and what the hell are you doing? So, I mean, you're...
Some of us did not.
and I feel like everyone's got the story about the person that they, you know, met online and they had a connection with, and maybe they never met that person, but in some ways they know that, like, that was, like, a kind of a...
Or or as I continually tell my father this, I'm like, met another friend from the internet, still not an axe murderer.
Still understand the distinction between reality and fantasy. Not confused there.
Yeah. Oh. I saw that hand first, and then you.
I'm completely with you, though, on the concept of the slices of dystopia underneath our virtual reality. I mean, of course, the stacks is clear, but for me, it's the bus ride.
The bus ride
suddenly where I'm like, wow, how broken are we? Yeah. Wait a second.
40 miles an hour, because that's how the roads are.
In armored vehicles
with gun riders on top.
No one cares.
Nothing.
Libertarian paradise.
Yeah. I'm like, wow, have we blasted the landscape to dust?
Pretty much, yeah.
And it's just a couple paragraphs, but it's like...
Oh, yeah, it gives you...
Here's a moment before we return to this.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it gives you that terrifying visage. All right, so your hand and then the person behind you.
I like what you said about, like, the character gets what they want. In some stories, that doesn't happen. But in this story, he follows through, he gets what they want. And the truth is, it's the girl, right?
Yeah.
And in the end, she has... Wade makes him look like his character slightly more handsome, right?
Yeah.
Same thing happens with the girl.
Yeah.
And in the end, he meets her, and she has a slight birthmark.
Yeah.
She's really self-conscious about it. But in the end, he loves her because he knows it looks really close to who he was looking for, right?
Yeah.
And, well, if I remember right, didn't the girl portray herself? Yeah, wasn't she like Artemis. Neutral throughout the whole book? Or
right,
am I?
Right. But she looked like what she looked like without the birthmark across her face. And then he met her in real life, so whether he still got the girl, it was still a story that we wanted. But at the same time, you know, Wade did other things. Wade had struggles where, like, he realized that he wasn't living as healthily as he should have. So he set up parameters that would make sure that he could work out every morning before he got online. And those are the kind of things that in real life, as an MMO player, I'm an MMO player. And like you said with H pretended to be someone that they weren't. But in real life, you have to cover your bases, right?
Yeah.
And Wade set up parameters for that.
Yeah, and I mean, it's like how my generation and I have Habitica as an app, which is Habit RPG, which is essentially, you know, you make your life a role-playing game, so you get XP for when you do things like, did not murder someone at work today, or...
Caught a Pidgey.
Yeah. Super Better gives you points for drinking water.
Yeah,
best
I mean,
game ever.
I mean, certain things like that, because, yeah, sometimes, you know, you can get wrapped up in something... I have had the fun thing of going on a riding jag and then coming out the other end going, okay, so it is a different day and I don't remember the last time I ate something.
Well, you know, I crack a joke about it just now, but, you know, I've actually lost 15 pounds since Pokemon Go came out.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and, or, you know...
And because of the game, yes.
I've got a question with the movie. How do you feel about whether the movie is going to be able to interpret from the book, how we feel from the book? Because I think that's going to be the most difficult thing the movie's going to do.
I'm slightly terrified about it.
For me, it's Spielberg. He gets a free pass from me. I mean, he has delivered more often than not, and even his not delivers are still better than anybody else's failures.
Well, I'm looking at it like this. If they had never, ever talked about making a movie, and all we had was that book, I would be going, man, I wish they'd make a movie out of this. And now they're making a movie out of it, I'm going, oh, man, they're gonna totally ruin it. I don't know. I don't know what to think. I don't know. So,
well, I mean...
You know, it's one or the other, really.
I mean, from what I've heard, the various cast members they've got, of course, unfortunately, the dream cast is unfortunately unavailable. Because Spielberg literally was trying to lure Gene Wilder out of retirement to play.
that would have been perfect.
But, you know, tell me about it. But you know, of course, now, you know, we know, of course, he was battling Alzheimer's, and that wouldn't have been possible even if they had been able to get him out of retirement, because he's just, you know, he was fading fast. But, you know, they've cast Mark Rylance, you know, who, as... Halliday, or who was the BFG, who was the spy in Bridge of Spies, died
That's good. That's a good choice.
Cromwell and
Wolf Hall.
Yes, awesome. Yes, he's been in everything lately.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's like Spielberg's Lucky Charm right now. I'm sorry.
Have they confirmed Simon Pegg?
Simon Pegg is in it, but I don't think they've confirmed who he's playing.
Oh, I heard he's playing
Ogden
Nash. The Woz character.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
In that case, yeah, I think you may be right.
Yeah.
The only character they haven't really confirmed is H.
Well, they haven't confirmed Wade yet either, that I've heard.
That's Ty from X-Men Apocalypse.
They've confirmed at least one of the Asian players.
Yeah. I mean, I know they're shooting it already. I mean, I saw a photo from the set the other day.
Shoto Daito, yeah, me too. Wade, Artemis. They've cast
iRock.
It's
supposedly T.J. Miller is in it, but I don't know who he's playing.
Yeah, they've confirmed everybody except for H at this point, and they can cast Sorrento at this point.
Yeah, and honestly, H is going to be the one that I'm most looking forward to because my big thing as a writer and as a creator, my big thing is representation and how we need more of it. Just above the board, and including H and the way that you have H's reveal kind of what made this book go from this is cool to this is amazing. And I keep with Good Omens, I keep buying copies and flinging it at people. So that's one of those that I'm going to be really excited to see who they get for that, and also terrified because there's so many ways for it to not go well,
and what they have to leave out and what they replace, because if they can't use stuff, they may have to just put something else in its place. And you know, in a way, I'm kind of looking forward to that, because I keep telling myself, well, think of it this way:
spot the new references.
Yeah, the new have a whole spot new passel of references to figure out. Right? I mean, instead of Dungeons and Dragons or Joust, it may be some other thing, and that'll be cool. So I'm okay with changing the flavors of the...
I was going to say, this movie could go to 11, and that might mean something completely different now.
Yeah, so...
Yeah, I think you and the maroon, you had...
I was talking about H, my cousin, right? Oh, this is a true story. My cousin has played a girl online on the MMO EverQuest for like 10 years. My cousin is homosexual, which is fine, right? But it was kind of like an out for him, right? It was a way for him to release this tension. Mm-hmm. And I feel like H is kind of the opposite. And I really can connect with H on a level where I'm like, I understand where H is coming from.
Yeah.
And H is a very skilled player, and I love that. And which is my cousin. My cousin's a very skilled player. I understand what it's like to MMO. When you're gaming, it doesn't matter what they are in your life. It's about the character, how good they are, how much they bring to the table as your team. You know, and MMOs, that's where you really feel that aspect. You're like, it doesn't matter where you come from, really. Who are you? On a player level.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like when you're in different role playing communities, whether that's journal based role play, whether that is, you know, MMOs, whether that's something like Democracy, something like that. It does come down a lot to the internet is a great leveling field in that sense for it. There are also pitfalls, because you can run across a whole hassle of the deep, dark dregs of the universe. But for the most part...
Oh, God, you know, don't get me started. No, I've actually had stalkers in real life because of the frickin' internet.
Yeah,
it's not fun.
But you do meet some shining, awesome, amazing people. I game. And I've been an RPG or online for longer than I care to admit to.
No, from years.
Yeah.
8 to 10 years?
Yes.
We're going to go up because I started role-playing sort of right around the time I also started lying about my age on the internet, so it has been a hot minute.
So you mean you haven't been role-playing since before the internet, like some of us? Hey, there was no internet when I started doing some of this stuff. Hey, I actually had one kid get really mad at me for being a fan of Star Trek, and it's like, you know, how dare you not be a fan of Star Wars? Well, it's like, I am a fan of Star Wars, but you have to remember, when I was your age, there was no Star Wars. I mean, yes, there was such a time, and it's hard to believe it now because I've been wearing the Star Wars belt buckle for 39 years. I'm not joking. The belts have changed. The buckle has not.
This lady over here, please.
Yeah. To go back on what you were saying about H, it isn't an equalizer because there is still that the stigma that the male rules the roost.
Yeah, and that's that's why I
played male characters because of that and have been treated completely different from playing female characters.
Yeah.
And that's what's appealing about H and the backstory between H's mom being a black woman, being a white male businessman. Because that's reality and virtual reality. There is a level that you, although it's an equalizing thing, you all have an image.
And
that's why it's not just, I'm going to make myself a little bit prettier. I'm going to make myself not have the scar. I'm also making myself into something that gives me more privilege.
Yeah, I mean, that is the case. I mean, that's why, you pick gender-neutral pen names.
Yeah, I mean, that's why, Harry Potter was published by J.K. Rowling. They told her Jo Rowling would, or Josephine or whatever, I mean, the female version would never sell.
I didn't know that.
She went under J.K. because they told that it sounded
like lots of female writers over the years that have.
Oh yeah,
I'm one of them.
Yeah, exactly. I know, but I'm just saying this is a real thing. This has been going on forever. DC Fontana. I mean,
absolutely.
I mean, and yeah. CJ so on the one hand, it does give us a lot more power. On the other hand, it's still not a completely equal world. Okay, I saw a hand over here first, and then we'll get to you back there. There was a hand over here.
I know we talked about how the book suggests the internet as an escape from a whole crappy country scenario. But I also appreciate it saying, that some people need the internet as an escape from, maybe an abusive or just really shitty family and home life, and that's okay.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
It's not cool to judge people for that because, everybody here knows that that's a great thing, but out in real life when you're with not nerds, you get criticized for being in another world.
Well, a lot of people can't socialize, without that front that they can put up, and that's one of the things that the book plays off of is, they need the Oasis just to function. I mean, because they don't have whatever it takes to do it in real life, but that brings them to the point where they can do it, it gets them out.
Even in the book, they talk about it. Wade wound up having acute agoraphobia when he was trying to leave. When they arrested him and took him outside, everybody he was with could not survive out in the daylight. They're like putting hoods over them just so they didn't have to see the outdoors.
And the Japanese had like the lost generation where all the kids would have their food brought to them in their room and never leave their room. It was really depressing.
I mean, and there's still that like I. Hilariously enough, I am an introvert. this is a good bubbly front because all of you are my people. and that's the reason why I can do this. But it is hard. And before I started doing panels, my very first panel, I was absolutely terrified. But you do get to a sense of we are awesome nerds nerding out about the same exact thing. So, and that takes a lot of the pressure off, and it was pretty good to see that sort of experience filtered out in the book too. So, dude in the back who is really patient.
No, you.
Yeah, you.
I just wanted to go back to your comment about J.K. Rowling. I find that has to be possibly the most untrue thing that they could have told her, because some of the powerhouse authors of fantasy literature and even urban fantasy literature are female, and obviously female. Patricia Briggs, Anne McCaffrey, Mercedes Lackey, and they've been there for years. And for them to tell her that she couldn't sell that is hit me.
Well, it's apples to oranges. I mean, it happens. I mean, it happens regardless. I mean, it's been going on for years.
I'm not saying that the discrimination isn't there in some people's minds, and that it doesn't happen. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that they could tell her she couldn't sell it. It just seems to me as a mind-boggling concept because there are so many very, obviously, very prolific female authors.
Well, bear in mind that every publishing company in the world told her they couldn't sell it regardless of what her name was. Mm-hmm. Much less being female. Right, right. So,
what
I mean.
Was her name?
Well, yeah, her new family name was Robert Galbraith, but that's a whole other story because she basically did that because she wanted to see what, you know, if people would buy something that didn't have J.K. on it, you know, whether or not they would, you know, they even give it a look, see if people would even look at it fairly if her name wasn't on it. Because by that point, you know, her name was bigger than Stephen King, just about, you know, so.
Yeah.
I wanted to address the point about, you know, J.K. Rowling. I've been managing a chain bookstore for the last 6 years. Mm-hmm. And so from experience, I will say the publishing industry, sadly, was right. At the adult level, we don't pay that much attention. But at the kids level, trying to get an 8-year-old boy to pick up a book written with a girl's name on the cover is an uphill fight.
Yep.
Constantly. And it's not right, but it is something we deal with.
But it, you know, it is. I mean,
it's something I deal with every day, trying to sell books to boys. It's like, it doesn't matter that it's got a girl's name on the cover or that the character is a girl. You're going to like the book. Read it. But that's probably why they told her that, is because trying to get an 8-year-old boy to pick up a book with a girl's name on the cover is a struggle.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, I mean, and you're absolutely right. It is a struggle. I mean, it's... I have nieces and nephews, and, you know, most of them will be like, oh, no, Auntie B gave you something, you read it, because Auntie B is never wrong.
God. But it's written by a girl.
But it's written by, it's written by a girl. We actually had a friend of ours, a friend of one of my nephews, who was like, but it's written by a girl. He's like, yeah, and the girl is awesome, and my Auntie B is never wrong, so you should read this book. But his friend was still
skeptical.
So I'm like, no, turn to page 84, read the cool sword fight, then go back and start the book. So, you know, he sold him on it, but yeah, it was an uphill battle for that. So yeah, you're absolutely right about that. So
that's where you grow up.
Yeah. It really is. So
interested to hear, like, from people that are under the age of 30.
I'm out.
I'm out.
Any of the game references, any of that, just going into
I can
the
address
book,
that.
Please do.
Sci-fi or gaming book.
Well,
my daughter is 17, and she read it last year and loved it. She didn't get any of it. Nothing. And she loved it as a story, as a character story.
Yeah. I mean, like, we read it, we're 24, and I think he got more of the references than I got, like, you know, I know Back to the Future, and, like, you know, that's about it. And I still loved it, and I think it, like, says something about the book that it appeals to people who know the references, and I'm sure it's probably richer to you all than it is.
Well, I think a lot of it's going to end up being, like, you know, what the Looney Tunes were like, or what Animaniacs is like, probably for your generation also, is, you know, you're going to get it. But you're going to really get it when you grow up and learn all the rest of the references.
Yeah.
Have they talked about the movie? Are they trying to keep that flavor? Because that was what I was afraid of, that they think, we need to make this relevant for the millennials. So let's start putting some 90s references in there, some 2000 references.
No, I think more of what I've heard about what them doing is like I said, Spielberg making it so it's not a Spielberg, you know, wank fest, you know, but toning down the Spielbergisms but you know, keeping it, you know, as is. I mean, who knows what the screenwriters have done? But
there are still 90s and 2000s references, and there's a Firefly in the book.
Yeah,
That's right.
Speaking as someone who is exactly 30 and got every reference in the book, I mean, it also kind of comes, it also kind of depends on how you were brought up, because our joke is I was incubated as a nerd, so because both of my parents are really big nerds, so I have literally seen every single one of these movies over and over. I mean, one of my favorites was the War Games reference.
Right.
Because... you know, the number of people I know my age who've seen that movie is very slim.
Really?
Surprising the number of people who have not seen that movie.
Because see, the one thing that's different about these days is, you know, when I was a kid, you know, because you know, if you think about it right now, the nostalgia in this for the '80s you know, as I think somebody pointed out, it's like Star Wars came out closer to the end of World War II than it did to today.
Yeah.
And that just hurts. But the point is, you know, people today have a much greater access to the stuff of the last 20, 30 years before them than people did when we were in the 60s and the 70s and 80s, you know. You know, because the Marx, you know, think about, you know, now that, you know, the Marx Brothers are getting ready to put out a whole new box set. People love them. In the 70s, they were almost completely forgotten about because you couldn't see the films. And it wasn't until, like, somebody found some prints and they did some big retrospective in, like, 72. And all of a sudden, they became this big thing again. But it was so hard to see anything that wasn't current back then. There was no, you didn't, you know, you didn't have access to the last 60 years of films. You know, on your Netflix account, you know, you know, that's one of the reasons why, not to do this to pitch one of my own projects, but Horror Hosts, that's one of the reasons why Horror Hosts were such a big thing in the 60s and 70s, was because they were one of the few people who were putting all this great old stuff out there and telling you how great this was, and you got to check this out.
Yeah.
You know, and you had very, you just didn't have the same access back then that you do nowadays. So to me, it seems like the kids nowadays have a greater understanding of past nostalgia because it's easier to get access to it.
Yeah.
Bear in mind also that that's the characters in the book. They're not from the 80s.
Yeah.
They're young compared to
that. Because of the egg hunt, you know, you've gone through every line of everything. And that also speaks to, like...
James Halliday. You know, he's my age now, you know. So, you know, I'm 49 now. So by the time we get to the point of this book, you know, he is... You know, if you're around 45 to 50, you are the same age as Halliday, just not yet.
Speaking of war games, there's we're getting ready to do a White Rocket episode where Mark Buskett, movie reviewer, and I go back and look at the Reagan era Cold War movies, like
Cloak and Dagger,
Hunt for Red October, Gorky Park, that kind of stuff, and we watched War Games. And I was surprised just how dated it really is. This is the scene that blew my mind, is that this is a movie about computers and starting World War III and everything.
And logging in.
And at one point, Matthew Broderick goes to the library and pulls out the card catalog drawer and is going through cards. And I'm like, whoa! In a movie about computers, they're digging in a card catalog. That absolutely blew my mind. So
right on that bridge.
Yeah, it really was. It really was, yeah.
Well, and then, you know, you've got the... you've got all the other stuff with the dangers of artificial intelligence and how all of that interplays, and then, you know, with the tic-tac-toe game, you know.
That's the one thing that Ready Player One didn't do, is turn the Oasis into any kind of a malevolent threat on its own, and I think that's good because it serves the purpose of the plot, which is... humans are the problem. It's just the drug, right? It's just the enabler. It's not the
technology is the tool.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the Oasis is something we couldn't have envisioned, you know, in the 80s. I mean, you know, even in the earliest days of, you know, I've actually been online, you know, since what, 1988, I think, on some of the old WWIV, you know, local message boards, not pre-internet, but, you know, pre-web. But, you know, even back then, you know, the whole idea of the social, you know, this just completely interconnected social network is just, it's just alien to, you know, somebody of the 80s. It's, I mean, it's great to an extent, but.
More than that, I'm looking at the comparison of people now and before, they have access to more.
Yeah.
But that also means they see less. Mm-hmm. Back in the 60s and 70s and early 80s. There was no cable.
Mm-hmm. All right.
You had five channels. So when there was an old movie on,
you watched it.
You watched
that was what you had.
That may be the only chance you get.
Right. All of the old 50s movies, all of the old shows, they were there for you, or else you had to watch wrestling.
Or Hee Haw.
Or Saturday. Cartoons went off when Soul Train came on.
That's right.
So we knew. So you knew what it was. There was not a lot of choices. Now, there are so many choices that I just don't think there are They may be exposed, but they don't see it.
Yeah. One of the things along that lines, I remember when one of the things I used to do with the Force.net is I used to help run their fan film section. This is pre-YouTube, you know, and we helped a lot of the first fan films get on the web because we provided them the bandwidth and a site for them to host their stuff. But the thing that we did was we also, you know, picked through all the chaff and only presented the really good stuff because bandwidth was so expensive back then. Mm-hmm. You only wanted to show the good stuff. So, but there was only like one or two places where you could go where people did that. And nowadays, anybody can get their stuff on the web. But the problem is there's so much stuff out there, it's almost impossible to find out what's good. Whereas back in the day, you know, you went to one site and they told you, oh, you want to watch Troops, you want to watch Batman Dead End, you know, stuff like that. And nowadays, it's like, well, let's look on YouTube and hope we get lucky.
Well, and I think that's why the social media stuff is also so important now, just because word of mouth goes for a lot farther than you might necessarily think. I mean, in groups of people, like, you have a Twitter account, you've got a following, you know, I read very, very fast, naturally. Like, to give you an idea, Harry Potter 7 took me about 2 hours and 25 minutes to go from start to end and stopping partway through to cry for 5 minutes before I started reading again. And I have no shame about admitting that's what happened, because there are still tear stains in that
always
book. Seriously, you killed Fred. I'm done. But basically, you know, so I can go through a lot. So I have a bunch of people from college, from conventions and stuff, who will just find me and go, I need a new book to read. I hate this. I love this. Give me a book. And I will just go to my Excel spreadsheet and, well, my Open Office spreadsheet, because Microsoft Word is expensive, and just pick off a random number off the books where the criteria and just send it to him and say, if you hate this one, let me know, and I'll find you a new one. But different stuff like that. I mean, and I have like 5,000 books currently cataloged, and it keeps growing. And those are just the ones I have in my personal library. So all the other ones I know from word of mouth that are really super good. I mean, I've shot a couple people his way, so...
Bless you.
So yeah, I mean, it's word of mouth does carry for a lot, but you've also got to work at that. So... I saw hand, and then hand.
Listening to the question about, you know, younger people and what they take from the book, just really played up an idea, and I really enjoy it, of that Klein's actually producing some of the effect that he describes in his book, because honestly, even growing up with a lot of this, I didn't know 2112, I didn't know Spider-Man. These are things that I now have experienced and gone and looked for, because of the references and being excited about it in the books. And it's very cool in the sense of this is how the whole concept of the culture grew up in the book, but also, you know, this is introducing to a bunch of people who don't know anything about it.
Yeah.
And learning new geekdom.
And that's also some of the great parts about this is that, you know, reading this and going back and going, okay, it has been a while since I have seen this movie. Where is this movie? I'm going to rewatch it. And then my roommate will be like, oh, I've never seen this movie. I'm like, all right, sit your ass down.
That's exactly the point. Like, yeah, that whole younger demographic discovering all this stuff is a major...
Yeah, it's like, you know, how many kids got introduced to Willy Wonka this week? You know?
Right. Oh, a bunch.
Man, I'm
going to start crying. What? This is a good thing.
Super true.
Speaking of tears.
R.I.P. Yeah, like the main demographic on the subreddit is mid-teens to mid-20s. Most of them did not grow up with this stuff. But they read Ready Player One and like, oh, awesome, I want to go find how to I can play Black Tiger online now. Or I want to watch Blade Runner and learn what the heck a void comp text has. And yeah, this is a discovery tool.
Yeah, I mean, I had a couple of people who I sent the book to who then texted me back, because my thing is that if I give you a book and you read it and you like it, you text me back with something that you got out of the book. So I got a whole bunch of, like, Blade Runner quotes. Text message with Blade Runner quotes. I'm like, oh, okay.
I got, do you have Max Headroom?
all right, I saw you, and then I saw you, and then I saw you.
My comment was basically to piggyback off of your comment, which is basically, well, I read Ready Player One. I'll give you a perfect example. Heathers, the movie Heathers. I had never seen Heathers.
You have fixed this, I hope.
funerals, a funeral scene, and in Heathers that scene is so intense and beautiful. And when I read the book again, and that scene came up again in the book, I saw the visual, and it was so beautiful.
Yeah.
And I love that. I feel like this book takes us back and makes me learn about things I never knew about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, yours, and then yours, and then yours.
So again, I think that the most important thing that the movie can capture about the book is the sort of timeless quality of the culture that the story is referencing. As an example, I watched Airplane growing up, and I didn't really understand a lot of the references. You know, the very physical gags were funny, but you watch that movie again multiple times, and as you, especially over the course of several years, and you'll find little things in it that you're just like, oh my god, that is really funny, and it's totally not even a part of the plot. It's just something happening in the background that you don't hardly even notice, and then you make the connection because you have that knowledge that you get as you grow older and you're exposed to more things.
Now, here's the thing that'll blow your mind. Have you ever watched Zero Hour? Zero Hour is the movie that Airplane is a parody of, and in some cases, it's a line-by-line recreation. I mean, they didn't alter the script. They're just, and they're not even playing it funny. Go watch Zero Hour, and you'll be shocked because it's Airplane without being funny. I mean, almost all the way down to the. I mean, I think the gladiator joke wasn't in there, but I mean,
oh, yeah. Okay.
If they can capture that quality, and then like other people said, inspire the younger generation to revisit that stuff, it'll keep it alive.
Well, I mean, the great thing about, I mean, we'll get to him in a second, but, it's like, you know, everything is a remix. I mean, you know, I mean, everything inspires everything else in some way or another, sometimes a little bit more blatantly than others. You know, in the case of Zero Hard Airplane, or in the case of, what was it? You go and you look back, and it's not Treasure, it's, because Humphrey Bogart, his costume, he's Indiana Jones. I mean, it literally is Indiana Jones' costume.
It is.
Yeah. Right, we have like 10 minutes left.
Yeah, less than 10.
Your question? Yeah.
Can we talk about that Atari movie, which had Ernest Cline in it and George R. R. Martin in it and the mysterious buried Atari cartridges, the millions of E.T.
E.T. cartridges, yeah.
Oh, that. Mm-hmm.
It was good. I mean,
it was.
Yeah. Bad. I thought it was
good. Oh, no, it was. I'm just sitting here going, I'm like, oh, man. I'm sitting there looking at all those very Atari cartridges going, where did you find all of those?
Well, because, I mean, it was an urban legend that they dumped all these things, and it turned out to be true. I mean, I don't know how many of you guys remember this, but I remember there were days where when some of the new Atari games would come out, I mean, I remember the stock people just standing at the back door and just throwing cartridges out into the horde because they couldn't even put them on the floor. I mean, they literally were just throwing stuff out of the back room at people, and people were just catching it because some of the, like when Pac-Man first came out, right, or you know, some of the other, you know, really popular.
And they were so bad on Atari too, but people just had to have it, man.
Yeah, awesome. Okay.
Oh, they were, but they were terrible.
Yeah,
except for River Raid.
Yeah. VR is Activision. I mean, we are actually in a world right now where we can go and experience some of these things that were a few years ago in this event and still a fantasy.
Yeah.
So the fact that this is happening, it's in our lives, and this idea of, one of my favorite parts is when he's reliving these famous movie scenes, and he's in them, he's saying the lines, and he's getting points. But I think that's so awesome and so close. I mean, that could happen in a few years.
Yeah, I mean, and it's both a really cool, shiny thing that we should absolutely develop, and also a really good warning about how we need to not abuse the technology. It is pretty fascinating. I saw your hand next.
Speaking of related media, so I loved Ready Player One so much that I'm scared to read Armada because I don't want to ruin it.
Let's talk about Armada for a second. We won't spoil it. Don't spoil it. It just came out.
That I've not read, so.
I'm about 2/3 of the way through it. It's not as bad as people have been saying, but it's not as good as Ready Player One. It's kind of...
But most people's sophomore efforts generally,
yeah.
You know...
Yeah. No, it's... But it's again, he's trying to pull in a bunch of references. But see, here's... All right, I don't think this spoils anything just to say this. When I heard the premise of it, I thought, isn't that just the last Starfighter?
Yeah.
And it is, but I just want to tell him... Saying, hey, this is like The Last Starfighter, doesn't make it less like The Last Starfighter. In other words, having your character acknowledge that he's basically recreating it doesn't absolve you of recreating an existing story, you know? And I'm just reading it going, I don't think that really cleared it up there, you know? Mm-hmm. So
I just wanted to say my daughter gave me the book, mm-hmm. and she'd read it. And once I started reading it, we had a blast just going back and forth with, because she's she's 21 years younger than I am. And so I introduced her to a lot of this stuff. And so we'd sit and we'd talk and she goes, well, did you see this? What'd you think of this, brother? And we just had a great time. We bonded.
Yeah, my parents recently, because Van put me on the panel, and so I was telling my parents about my con schedule. And my mom's like, she's like, Ready Player One. She's like, what that? What's that? And I'm like, I'm sorry. I have failed as a child. Hold on 1 second. Grab the copy of my entry copy of the book, hand it to her, and said, okay, if there's a reference you don't get, text me and we'll watch whatever it is. Because that's how we do it in my family, because my dad's sitting here going, oh my gosh, somebody remembered this was a thing, and this was a thing. He's still blowing up my phone because they're going through it now. So every time you watch me clearing text messages, it's my dad going, oh my god, they remembered this was a thing. I'm like, yes, dad.
Before we run out of time, I gotta tell you this one quick little story here, because obviously if you're I know that's why I'm doing it now. If you read Ready Player One, obviously you see all these bits from other books and games and movies and stuff, but I had a very personal experience with it aside from that. Now, it's a total coincidence. I'm not alleging anything, obviously. I'm gonna be ridiculous, but total coincidence aside, I wrote Stellarax in 2010, okay? And I got to the part in Ready Player One, let me just tell you, there's a scene in Stellarax where I have my main character put a nuclear warhead inside a little robot and send it inside an otherwise impenetrable thing to blow it up from the inside. And I got to a certain scene in that book and I went, holy crap! So it's almost like, you know, you're seeing Back to the Future, you're seeing War Games, you're seeing all that. I saw my book in it! Now, again, I know it, but still, it's just amazing. There's so many little things in it that you will see a little bit of everything in it, you know. It's really amazing. So. You went to...
Did anybody else, in the scene you're referring to, where the robot was carrying it out, did anyone else picture Johnny Five?
Yes.
Yes.
Exactly. We probably were supposed to, yeah.
Or if we take it back even further, little droids from Darkstar.
Yeah.
I just want to piggyback a little bit about what you're saying about people, how they're learning. So I just encountered my niece this last week, and she had a little baby girl, a year old. I referenced The Princess Bride, and her half-sister are both the same age, about early, you know, just under 30. What? And I went,
what?
Wait a minute, you are not allowed to have a child unless you have seen it. So, in what this new generation is doing, they immediately got on their phones and looked up the trailer for Princess Bride and other reference. And all through our conversation down to that weekend, anytime I brought up some obscure little quote or something like that, she got on her phone and started looking up the reference.
Mm-hmm.
And well, it was kind of scary, but she's not absorbing the whole thing. She's only getting that one tidbit.
Well, see, and the thing is, sorry, people who haven't seen The Princess Bride are just like, I can't even, because literally my first live-action movie was The Princess Bride. I was 18 months old.
Okay, I really didn't need to hear that.
I was in college.
College kids, like 18, 19, 20-year-olds, no idea what Star Wars is.
Adults.
Yeah. Good God. I mean, I don't know if they're adults, but they're old enough that they should have seen.
Yeah, no. I was going to say, Vince heard me tell the story of the me and my sister fighting with the kitchen implements.
Over.
After we saw The Princess Bride, because we were recreating the fight scene.
Yes.
And I'm like, I think that was the second time I'd seen it. I was 3 and my sister was 1.
I think the girl over here in the green.
You're both still alive, thank goodness.
Sorry. As another element that came out of the book, who participated in the real life egg hunt? Because that was super cool.
Oh right! I remember reading about it, but because they did give away the prize, you know, there was some guy did get the DeLorean.
It's something about that. There was clues throughout the book with the little things written in the chapter headings or something like that, and you could figure it out.
That's been a big thing for a while because I remember, Jordan Weissman sort of premiered, did a lot of that stuff. You know, with the first big one was for AI. You know, the whole alternate reality game they did around that.
What was the Atari beam? I can't, I'm having a brain fart. That he references in the book, the Earth series and the fire series.
Oh, yeah, it was Earth Quest or something like that, or Sword Quest.
My daughter.
And some of the prizes I don't think were ever given away for that. I think there was a Wired or Atlas Obscura did a big article about what happened to them.
Last few seconds here.
Just to give you a quick idea how much I think Spielberg will get some of this. I'll tell you a quick story. In addition to some of the other stuff I did a lot of work with Jordan Weissman on Crimson Skies. The original PC game. And Jordan was the guy who did the whole alternate reality game for AI. And at one point, he got a call from Steven Spielberg that there was a big problem, and Jordan had to call him right then to correct this. And Jordan thought this was going to be a problem with, you know, the AI game. And Spielberg was on the set, and so Jordan calls him up and says, "What's the problem?" And Spielberg says, "Look, this is very serious. I don't know how to defeat the Black Swan." Spielberg was playing Crimson Skies, the video game, on the set of AI and would not go back to directing until he figured out how to beat a level. So he called the creator of the game to talk him through it. So as far as a gaming's concerned, I think Spielberg's one of us.
All right, I think we're about out of time. We appreciate everybody coming out this late for it. Thank you so much. All right, and that was the Ready Player One panel from DragonCon 2016. Please be sure to visit whiterocketbooks.com and check out all the latest stuff we have there. Anything you purchase absolutely benefits the show, helps us to be able to continue the podcast and the Avengers Assemble podcast and all of our other shows, including our new upcoming show on Her Majesty's Secret Podcast, where we will be doing a massive World Cup of James Bond Films Tournament. First time we've announced that anywhere. We will have the World Cup of James Bond Films Tournament coming up very soon on this same network. So keep an eye out for that. Otherwise, the Rocket's going to get on out of here for another episode, and we'll see you guys down the road.
Griffin, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.
The Avengers Assemble podcast from White Rocket Entertainment. Creator and fan interviews and discussion about Marvel's Avengers comics, movies, and everything else. From Van Allen Plexico and the Jarvis Heads of AvengersAssemble.net, creators of the best-selling Assembled books and the most fanatical Avengers fans on the face of the earth.